I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast. This is going to be episode number 267, and John, there's a fireplace behind me.
Yes, there is. You have a new recording space there, which maybe we can get into a little later, but my name is John Anilio. I'm a podcaster and a teacher and a composer and a musician. You can check me out at johnanilio.com. You can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio, and that is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, podcaster, lots of other stuff going on with him these days too, and you can check him out at atfmb.com and at atfmb on Twitter. Today, we are very happy to be joined by, I didn't ask him how to pronounce his name, but I hope it's Alan Smale. And he is the author of Clash of Eagles and Eagle in Exile, which is just coming out as this episode airs. I believe it is going to be on the release day of his new book. He, in addition to being an author, he also works for NASA, which is awesome. And he performs in a high energy vocal band called The Chromatics, which I, being a musician, I certainly want to get into. You can check him out at alansmale.com and on Twitter at Alan Smale. Alan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah. And sorry about all I'm normally together a little better, but I had some technical difficulties in the beginning of the show, and Alan has been very nice and patient while we worked that out.
Oh, and it's even beyond that, John, because Alan and I have been doing this podcast dance for years.
Really?
Where we've been trying to get him on. And I mean, Worldcon and in person and other stuff. And it utterly fails, and it's always my fault.
Oh, well, great. Well, I'm glad. Well, I worked it out this time.
Yes, I'm ridiculously excited because Alan is an awesome guy.
Cool. And I have to thank his publicist because his publicist reached out to me.
No, we're not giving any credit to the publicist.
No credit for publicist.
None.
No, but thank you for thank you to Alan's publicist for getting on today. Alan, so much cool stuff to talk about. I am reading. I am. My Kindle tells me that I am 60% through Clash of Eagles, and I'm really loving it so far. And you have the brand new book coming out, Eagle in Exile, which is the next book in the series. And certainly want to get into that in the main part of the show, asking a little bit because I think it's such interesting stuff. But maybe before we get into the book and all that, I'm sure our listeners would love to know a little bit about your day job working for NASA. So maybe you could I don't know how much you're allowed to tell us about that.
We only want classified stuff.
So maybe just give a little snippet of what some of the stuff you do at NASA.
Okay, sure. And I can certainly talk about it. I work at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, and that's in Greenbelt, Maryland. And I'm a research scientist. So on the research side, I do research into X-ray binaries, which are close binary systems where one of the stars is a black hole or a neutron star. So they're extremely powerful sources. They blast out across the universe in X-rays, and we measure the X-rays with satellites. Another part of my job is I'm the director of an archive center where we archive data from X-ray and gamma ray satellites and make it available to the astronomical community and to anybody who's interested. So that's my day job.
What do you think about Planet Nine?
Planet Nine, which one? I was very fond of Pluto before they demoted it from being Planet Nine, but I'm very excited to see that we're still discovering like huge bodies out at the end of our own solar system, even as we're making all these other great discoveries.
Do you think the evidence is pointing to an actual planet out there?
I think it is, yes. I mean, there may be some fine-tuning and some details to do, but I think we're on the right track there.
That is so freaking awesome. I mean, yep. It's, you're right. It's like we're still discovering stuff in our own solar system.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
My son has been watching the Bill Nye the Science Guy episodes on Netflix the last month or so, and they had a whole solar system thing, and they were talking about Pluto, and I'm like, oh, it's sad. This is now out of date because they're still calling Pluto a planet, but who knows? They'll probably turn it around and make it back into a planet.
Do you think, Alan, that the new Planet Nine is inhabited and that they have a plan from outer space?
They might do. We should be afraid, very afraid.
All right. Well, you know, I think, you know, because I have so,
shaking
so
his head sad.
No, I, you know, I
Patrick, it's been a month. I haven't had to deal with this shit.
I always find our intros to be, you know, a tough balancing act because there's so many questions that I'll often have for the main part. And I'm just like, well, if I ask one of those questions now, then we're just going to go off on that.
Let's do this real quick. Alan, have you ever met Karen Burnham?
No, I don't think I have.
Okay, so she was a NASA engineer for many, many years, but I think she was in Houston, based out of Houston. She was, she always liked to tell people that, that her job was essentially she got to blow shit up. Mm-hmm. that was her job. So I was just curious if you guys had ever been in the same circles. Have you ever gone to like ICFA?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't. I'd like to go there some year. Obviously, I'm not there yet now, but I do hear good things from people who go there and they say it's great and that I should go.
All right. I was just curious. Go ahead, John.
Cool. Well,
I'll stop derailing you. Before I might even stop interrupting you.
Oh, maybe at some point.
A likely story.
Before we get on to our picks, I do want to remind people that this show is supported by you, the listener, by our Patreon.com page. If you're interested in supporting the show, it's just go to Patreon.com/functionalnerds, and you can join the over 40 people who give us a few dollars every month to help us do this. And, you know, if you could do a dollar a month, that's great. That really helps us out a lot, covers our costs and helps us keep going. And if you go up to the $5 level or more, you can be in on watching these interviews live as they're taking place, and special, you know, Patreon only episodes or Patreon early episodes. And so if you like the show, you like us talking to cool, smart folks like Alan, consider going over to our Patreon, patreon.com/functionalnerds. And let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Alan, do you have a pick this week?
I do have a pick. You're not going to be able to see it in the stores just yet, but I've been asked to read a book called New Pompeii by Daniel Godfrey. And that's going to be coming out in June. So I have an ARC of it. And it actually has a strong Roman connection, which is, I suspect, why I was sent it. As you find out when we talk more about my book, I'm really into Romans and have been for many years. And this is actually a really interesting take on time travel. I know. An interesting take on like time travel and on Romans in particular. Essentially, the inhabitants of the Roman city of Pompeii get pulled through time just before the volcano erupts and destroys their city. And so they're in this new fabricated city that they... that they for a while believe is the real one because it's been sculpted and architected so well. And it's about really the clash of cultures there between the modern culture and basically the corporate people who are trying to exploit the Pompeians and the Romans themselves. And I think it's actually a really cool book, and it should be coming out in June. The on sale date, I guess, is the 21st of June. So I really enjoyed reading that.
So cool. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Ask your question first, John.
I was going to say once again, who is the author?
Is Daniel Godfrey. He's a Brit. Okay. Maybe another reason why they sent it to me.
So being a nerd that I am, Alan, I actually took Latin in high school. That was my language elective in a public high school, which is a trip. But we studied Pompeii quite a bit. What I always found actually cooler than Pompeii was Herculaneum.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
John, do you know that city?
No, I don't. I don't.
So so if I remember correctly, Pompeii got hit with the lava. Mm. Herculaneum got hit with the ash.
Mm.
And so they blanketed the whole city.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically choked to death instead of burned to death.
Right. And they got essentially smothered. And one of the interesting things is in both Pompeii and Herculaneum is how little they've excavated. They've done a large amount of excavation, but there's still whole huge areas that are still under ash and rock and dust and crap. And one day I hope they'll dig it out and they'll be finding out even newer things. There's always something new to study in history, as I keep telling anybody who'll listen. It's really quite fascinating how much more we know than we used to.
The guy who was digging out was digging out his yard to make a driveway for his pub in Ireland, discovered remains that are 2,000 years older than any other remains they found in Ireland, and point to the Irish, which is my heritage, actually not coming from the Celts after all.
I haven't really read into that yet. I've noted it, amazing. And I want to go back and read about it, but that was awesome. And also recently they found the bones of Richard III underneath a parking lot, underneath a car park in England. And it's just like, wow, nobody was expecting that to happen.
No. And John, there's a very cool museum in Los Angeles called the J. Paul Getty. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, it's a replica of a Roman villa from Pompeii.
That is very cool.
It's awesome. I remember going there as a kid.
Cool. Cool. Patrick, why don't you give us your pick next?
I haven't talked enough.
No, well, I can do my pick for next
time. No, I'll do it. Yeah. Well, because we're recording this on the 19th of March, My pick is going to be Daredevil Season 2.
Ooh.
And now, I have already watched 2 episodes. They were not punishing at all. They were, in fact, quite good. I was very happy with it. The first season, hopefully everybody has seen it by now, was a little bit of a slow burn, right? Because it was like year one for Daredevil, and he was coming into his own and trying to figure out how he was going to be a hero and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, slowly building the costume and everything. And season 2, all that's over with. It's just jump right in and shit starts happening immediately. And one of the things that I always liked about the Marvel comics when I was a kid, especially Spider-Man and Daredevil, was how they struggled with real life. You know, Peter Parker could never pay his rent, could barely eat. You know, he was hand to mouth most of the time. He was begging J. Jonah Jameson to buy a picture so he could, you know, buy film for his camera kind of stuff. And Daredevil was the same way. Matt Murdock was always struggling to survive because basically, you know, he's in one of the poorest parts of town. He's in Hell's Kitchen. He's trying to help poor people. And that has really come to the forefront in season 2, which I kind of liked it. It just makes it feel more real.
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into it. It just came up, I guess, last night, right? Yeah, just started. So yeah, so I'm looking forward to getting into season 2 of that. So very cool. My pick this week, a little bit different, is Herbie Hancock's autobiography. Herbie Hancock is a great jazz piano player, and he put out a biography in 2014 called Herbie Hancock Possibilities. And I actually listened to the audiobook of it, which is great because he does it. So it's basically him telling his life story. And if you are a jazz fan at all, it is, even if you're not, I just think it's a really interesting story of a creative person and a creative life. And I didn't really know much about his career. I knew he played with Miles Davis, and I knew he had, you know, a successful solo career, but he did so much. He played in one of Miles Davis's sort of classic quintets in the early 60s, along with Tony Williams on drums, Ron Carter on bass, Wayne Shorter on saxophone, and obviously Miles Davis on trumpet. But then he later went on to do all this like funk and fusion, and had all these like sort of, he did like the Fat Albert music to one of the Fat Albert cartoons early on. And then had one of the things that he did, which I found really interesting, was that he was really quite a pioneer in the use of synthesizers.
Oh yeah.
He and obviously he had the big hit with Rocket, in the very early 80s, and they had that cool video that, I want to say it's Godley and Cream, who are the name of the guys. They were in a band called 10cc, but then they later went on to do all these revolutionary videos, their most famous one being Sledgehammer by Peter Gabriel. So they did all those big like artsy music videos. So they did Rocket. So just a really interesting thing. So if you're a jazz fan or just someone interested in, you know, someone's sort of creative journey, it's a really good read. And like I said, if you can get your hands on the audiobook, definitely worth checking out. So that's Herbie Hancock Possibilities. So check that out. So very good. Okay. So let's get on to the meat of it. So as I said, I'm about 60% of the way through Clash of Eagles. And just to give people a little bit of an idea, and Alan already hinted at it, that he is interested in Romans. And it's a very, you know, again, I get these arc sandwiches, which is lovely. And a lot of times they sit there for a long time before I get around to them.
It sounded like you said arc sandwiches.
Oh, arc sandwiches are delicious. And so it's been sitting here. And what happened was, I think almost on the same day when Alan's publicist emailed me, if you belong to Goodreads, you have all your friends on Goodreads and their reviews will come to you in an email. And one of my Goodreads friends gave high praise to Clash of Eagles and wrote a lot about it. And as I was reading this, the high praise of Alan's book, I'm like, this sounds like a really cool book. I'm going to read it. So the idea behind it is it's almost like a what if of what if the Roman Empire never fell? And they were the people that came over to settle North America. And would there be a clash between the Native Americans and the Romans, why, yes, there would be a clash. And what would that be like of having those two cultures clash? And I just thought that was such an interesting concept and one that I had never really seen explored before. And it gets into all of these things with, you know, way of life and being a Roman and, you know, just sort of the technological differences between them. And so if that doesn't make you want to read it, I don't know why you wouldn't want to read it, because I just thought it was like such a cool idea for a book. So you said you've had a long interest in Romans. So what made you decide to kind of extrapolate upon it and get to that, you know, having them sort of interact with Native Americans?
Well, around about the time that I came to the States, the 500-year anniversary of the Columbus voyages was happening, essentially. And so I got to think about things, about like different ways of in which that essentially invasion from Europe or Asia could have happened. So I thought about it a little bit at the time, but really the idea only got going after I read Charles Mann's 1491. And there's a section in there about Cahokia and about the Mississippian culture. And that's an extremely interesting culture. It kind of follows on from the Edina and Hopewell cultures. And there are, it's a civilization of mound builders. The city of Cahokia has like something like 120 mounds, and that's based where St. Louis is now. And there are other towns and cities all the way up and down the Mississippi and up the Ohio River. And I was reading about this, and it really kind of captured my imagination, and I knew I wanted to write something about that. And so I came back to my earlier musings about what to do about an invasion by a different kind of colonizing power. And it seemed clear to me, for some reason, it just seemed evident to my brain that it should be the Romans that should be coming across. It should be a clash between the Romans and the Iroquois and ultimately the Mississippians that would drive the story. And I found it very interesting to think about what that would be like, what a large-scale Roman invasion of a country would look like. I mean, in this case, the book starts with one legion coming over and the legion landing at the Chesapeake Bay and marching westwards into what to them is a wilderness, but is obviously very inhabited with a large number of different peoples. And so I found it really interesting to look at Romans with their technology levels, that kind of technology level, and see what they would have made of North America, this huge continent.
Well, and the Romans were very technologically, I don't want to say savvy, but I mean they were relentless, right? They had plans and they just executed them everywhere
yes.
they went.
They're extremely well organized. They did have a fairly good level of technical sophistication, and they had a system. They really had a system for getting things done. And that's kind of different from the way that the Spanish and the French and the English came over to this continent. They all had their own different motivations and their own different processes, but the Roman process would have been extremely different. And
yeah.
So having them marching in, I thought, was kind of interesting. So I had a lot of fun doing that. That's the start of book one.
Yeah, as I was reading it through you know, obviously it's a work of fiction, but then I started doing a little bit of research on the Cahokians, because first of all, I'm like, oh, is this a real tribe? Because I'd never heard of it before. I'd never come across it before. And you're right. It is a very interesting, them having the mound building. One of the things, and you introduced this idea fairly early in the book, so I don't, but I will give a warning of spoilers. If someone is super, mm-hmm. super spoiler sensitive, you know, maybe, you know, just, you know, tune out for a moment. But
spoilers,
you
do,
yeah. So the one concept that you introduced that the Native Americans have is their, you know, their use of flight, that they, mm-hmm. that they constructed, you know, essentially sort of like hang gliders and things like that. So where does that idea come from for you? Is that just a pure work of fiction on your part? Is there some sort of evidence that there was experimenting with that within the Native Americans? Where does that idea come from for you?
It's certainly a fictional thing. When I was doing research into Cahokia, all of the rest of the setting of Cahokia, the food people ate, the way the city was laid out, the way the houses were built, the huts and the other things that they made, all of those things are built on a strong foundation of research. And I did a lot of anthropological and archaeological research, reading, you know, academic treatises as well as kind of more popular accounts. And so I did a fair amount of work on that side. The flying side is purely conjectural. There is no evidence that Native Americans did leave the ground in that way. The hang gliders is indeed the best analogy for these things. They're really like static wings made of sticks and skins and sinew. And when I was designing them, I was designing them so that they had like the same kind of functionality and performance of good hang gliders today. So there's no actual evidence for that. But I did think that it was an interesting extrapolation. A lot of Native American cultures place great reverence on birds and on flying. There's a lot of flying iconography. There's a lot of imagery in the Cahokian and Mississippian culture. They have like thunderbird wings and hawk eyes and all kinds of other things which would lead you to believe that they held birds and flying in great reverence. So if you'll pardon the pun, it seemed like an easy leap to think of them actually trying to do something pragmatic about that. And of course, in the middle of Cahokia, you have this huge mound. The biggest mound in Cahokia is Monk's Mound, which is 1,000 feet across at the base and 100 feet high. And I just thought it would be really cool to see what would happen if people were trying to jump off that and fly. And so that became a large part of the book.
Yeah, I really loved it. And then as I was reading through, I did notice how well researched it was, because as I was kind of going through, it's kind of a nice thing about the Kindle is if you do have an internet connection and you do go on a word, it'll go to the Wikipedia page, and then you end up sort of doing all of this like Wikipedia rabbit hole of like reading long entries on Koga. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, oh yeah, that was real then, I guess. Oh, that was real then. So if you're the kind of person that really likes these sort of like historically based stories, I think it's definitely worth reading. Now, in terms of your interest in the Romans, what sort of specific because Romans were around for quite some time, what specific time period is something that you find particularly interesting about the Romans, and then in terms of the types of Romans that were landing in North America in your book?
In my book, the Romans are landing in North America in 1218 AD. So essentially, the Roman Empire hasn't fallen. When I was doing a lot of reading about Rome and my own periods of interest in the Roman history, are like the first couple of hundred years AD. I'm really interested in the first century, where you have Caligula and Claudius and all of that, and then beyond that through the Hadrian years and into the second century. In the third century, of course, that's when everything fell apart for Rome. There's the crisis of the third century. You have all kinds of emperors taking place one after the other. There's a lot of civil war. And so if you need the Roman Empire to survive, you have to somehow avoid or mitigate the third century. And so that's essentially what I did when I was extrapolating in my own world. In my book, the point of departure happens in 211 AD, when... So Septimius Severus had two sons. One was Caracalla and the other one was Gator. And in our world, Caracalla killed his brother and went on to rule by himself. And in my world, there was a civil war between the two of them, and Gator, who was much more reasonable than his sick and twisted older brother, ended up on top of the heap. And so as a result of that, we end up with a civilization that manages to endure. It keeps the kind of classical values that it had then. And so it's still recognizable. There's been some technology improvement, but it's still recognizable as a Roman legion and a Roman force 1,000 years later.
Now, another thing that is brought up, or at least mentioned a few times in the book, is the main character. I don't know if you pronounce it Gaius, or how would you pronounce your main character's name?
Gaius Marcellinus, although yeah. there is some argument about that.
Right. So Gaius refers to himself, or refers to his Stoic nature quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And I see Stoicism come up as a philosophy quite a bit these days. There seems to be a renewed interest in... Seneca and Marcus Aurelius and a lot of this writing. So I don't know if you have a particular interest in Stoicism as well, in terms of a philosophy that goes along with your interest just in Romans in general.
Not particularly as a personal thing, but I felt that it was important for Marcellinus to have something to hold on to. He's not a particularly spiritual or religious guy, at least at the beginnings of the books. And so it seemed to me that he had needed to have some foundation, because he goes through a lot of trials, a lot of hardship, a lot of life-changing experiences, shall we say, as he goes through the course of these books. And as a result, he becomes a more human character and less of the military strongman type. But it seemed to me that he would need something within himself to call on to get himself through a lot of those ordeals. And so I went with Stoicism because it seemed to be the thing that was most appropriate to his character and to his times, and something that I think would probably endure over the centuries.
Yeah, it's just something that I always see. I see a lot of writing about it these days. I like Tim Ferriss's nonfiction books quite a bit, and he's been doing a lot of work with Stoicism and doing a lot of audiobooks with that kind of thing. So it's something that is kind of, I think, on a lot of people's minds these days. So mm-hmm. Now to to change gears, I would be remiss if I did not ask you about your singing group and just your background in music. I have to know a little bit about it. So the name of your group is the Chromatics. At least this is from your website. I don't know how active you are these days, but maybe you could tell us a little bit something about your kind of history with music and about your singing group in particular.
Well, the Chromatics, we're a six-person vocal band. We've been singing together for over 20 years. We've had a few personnel changes along the way, but the main people in the group have been there from the beginning. And I was one of those. And so the group's been singing. We have a project called Astro Cappella, which is actually educational songs about the universe. So they're original songs about astronomy, and they're in use in schools across the country. But we're also very active just doing festivals and kind of ordinary gigs, if you like, that aren't related to science. We're still very active. We have a concert coming up at the National Air and Space Museum in a few weeks' time. We're doing a gig in a school. We're going to do a school performance on a Monday morning sometime soon. So we've been steadily performing over the years, and we're still very much enjoying it. I love getting up on stage, and it's very different from my day job at Nash, and it's very different from the writing world. So it's kind of like the third leg on my stool, if you like. It's a great thing to do, and I really enjoy it, and I really enjoy the people I do it with.
And we have several. You said that you do songs about space?
Yep.
Do you do the Galaxy song for Monty Python?
I know that song, but we don't do it. We tend to write our own stuff. Of the songs.
Yeah, no covers. So
it's mostly original music. But,
okay.
So we have songs about the solar system. We even have one that mentions Pluto. And we have songs about like X-ray astronomy. We have songs about the Doppler shift and a variety of other things. Yep. That sound effect is actually in the song. That's on our
Now, what's your sort of early experiences with music? Is it something you studied? Is it just, was it always more of a secondary thing to you? What's your first experiences with music like?
Okay, sure. So I learned classical guitar for 4 years when I was a teenager, and I was a member of a couple of bands, but they weren't very serious bands, actually bands with instruments at that point. And then at college, I was in a choir or two, a large-scale choir here or there. But it's really only with the Chromatics that I've been singing with a small ensemble and been taking lead roles, lead singing roles, that kind of thing. So really, you could say that the Chromatics is my first serious band, but I've been with them for a long time, and we've been doing a lot of stuff together.
Oh,
400 gigs or so over the years. Sorry,
wow.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, how do you work out the vocal arrangements? Is it one person that does it? Do you work them out as a group?
We take turns. There are several of us within the group who do a fair amount of songwriting and arranging. I guess there are three of us who do most of it. Patty Boyd, who's the music director, and John Meyer, who write a lot of the original music. I wrote several of the Astro Cappella songs, including the one about the Doppler shift and several others that are in the collection.
Because it's quite a challenge. I think that most people, I don't know if they'd realize the when you're having an a cappella group, how much has to be done in terms of working out the parts to get that full harmony, to make sure it all happens. It's very difficult to sing. I've sang in groups like that before. And when you're singing, and I believe you sing the bass parts, it's not just like, oh, I know this tune and I'm going to sing it. When you're singing a part that's not the main melody, it's quite a challenge because you're working through the harmony. So not only is it a challenge to sing, it's a challenge to arrange, which is a whole level of composing that I don't think your average person really appreciates as much work it has to go into that. So you said you kind of guys all take turns in terms of arranging the tunes.
Yeah, that's right. And when I'm doing it, I do a lot beforehand. I do a lot of actually writing things out in staves and trying to figure out the four-part harmonies, which then become six-part harmonies because there's six of us in the group. But there are some things that we also figure out on the fly. And I think everyone in the group does this slightly differently. We often, once we start seeing things together, we'll realize things that don't necessarily work. Then we'll kind of woodshed things on the fly and make them sound better.
Do you guys grade each other's voice leading and have like red X's when you guys have parallel fifths in it?
I don't think we're as organized as that.
No, that's a George Patrick. That is a music school joke. When you take your music theory classes and you do part writing, what you get it's kind of funny because you come from a guitar background, Patrick too. Whereas, and it's if you're a guitar player like I am as well, and then you go and study part writing, if you have voices that move in fifths, that's considered a big no-no when you're studying sort of classical voice leading. But what are you playing on a rock guitar? It's all parallel fifths. Like, that's when you move a power chord from one to the next, it's parallel fifths. Mm-hmm. So it's a totally different like school of doing it. So I remember getting a lot of, you know, red marks on my papers that like no parallel fifths. So
yeah, we try to avoid the obvious answer when we're making up chords, trying to make something up more interesting.
Yeah, of course. And then mm-hmm. you know, of course, if you're doing more of a modern thing, you know, the harmony gets extended and it's a much more open than just your very strict sort of classical voice leading. So cool. Mm-hmm. All right. So, you know, so now if you're listening to this on day one, I believe this, your second book in this series comes out on March 22nd. Am I correct there?
Yes, that's right. Eagle in Exile, which is the second one in the series, comes out on March the 22nd. From
Happy Book Day.
Yes. So if you are listening to this on the first day, if you've read the first book, go and buy the second book. If you haven't read the first book, go buy that one and the second one. Go buy them both. Yep. Go buy the hardcover and go buy the ebook. And I'm assuming there's audiobook versions as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, you having a music background, I don't know how much of an interest you take in the audiobooks, or if that's just all done outside of your control.
Well, it's done by a separate company. It's done by Recorded Books in New York. But they did consult me about the choice of the narrator and so on. And I have listened to the audiobook of book one. I haven't received the book two, the Eagle in Exile audiobook yet. But I really enjoyed, actually. Strange though it seems, I really enjoyed listening to my own words being spoken by somebody else and hearing how different some of it sounded when it's being spoken like that. Mm-hmm. There were some parts I thought, oh, that's harsher than I meant it to be. Or some parts were like, oh, that's actually quite funny, and I'm not sure I meant it to be that funny. But it is a completely different experience. I actually really enjoyed listening to my own audiobook, strange and perverse though that sounds.
Well, as people know, I am a huge fan of audiobooks now. I just absolutely love them. So I'm happy that yours are available as audio.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So as we said, so the book is out now. The second book is out, and people can check out your website, alansmail.com, and follow you on Twitter at alansmail. And you mentioned some gigs for the Chromatics, but are you going to be doing any cons either with the Chromatics or just as an author? Any place where people can go and check you out?
The Chromatics have been doing cons for quite some time. We were guests of honor at PhilCon a few years ago, and recently we were at Farpoint, which is a local convention. So we do hit the con circuit, and we'd like to do more of that, actually, because con audiences really understand what we're trying to do with the astronomy music. As for me, I'm going to be at WorldCon. I'll be at WorldCon in August, I guess it is, in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And I'll also be at World Fantasy. And I may be other places as well. We're still trying to figure out whether I'm going to be at the Comic-Cons. There's several Comic-Cons coming up, and I may also be doing those, but we have yet to figure that out. But certainly WorldCon and World Fantasy, I'm already set up for those.
Excellent. Very good, Alan. Well, thank you for being on the show today. We really appreciate it. I think, you know, I was telling my wife about the show. I was like, oh, who are you guys having on the show today? And I mentioned, like, isn't this awesome? Like, he writes these great books, and he works for NASA, and he's in a singing group. And she's like, you know, some people they just do everything well, you know?
Well, thank you. Thank her.
Yeah. So thank you so much for being on the show. Once again, for us, if you dig the show, you dig hearing stuff about Alan, go and check out patreon.com/functionalnerds. And Patrick, anything you want to mention to people before we wrap it up?
Yes. As of this recording, there are maybe 4 or 5 days left on a Kickstarter that is Apex Publications. It's called Upside Down, Inverted Tropes and Storytelling. It's an anthology. It's being edited by Monica Valentinelli and James Gates.
Okay.
Right. It's got authors that are friends of the podcast, like Maurice Broaddus, Delilah mm-hmm. Dawson, John Hunter Jacobs, Michael Underwood, and it's already funded. However, I'm going to encourage people to go out and still back it because there are stretch goals. One mm-hmm. of them is that myself and a couple other people are going to write essays for this. Mm-hmm. So it won't be sure. fiction, but it's going to be essays that we're writing about tropes and kind awesome. Of turning them on their heads. So check that out on Kickstarter, Upside Down, Inverted Tropes and Storytelling. It's an anthology. It's being published by Apex. So it's Jason, and we all know Jason, and Apex is a great company, and we know the editors, and they're great people. This is a wonderful project to back. And like I said, my stretch goal has already been met, so I do have to write an essay for them. So
awesome. Cool. So all right, everybody. All right, thanks. All right, everybody, have a great week, and we will see you next time.
It's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned. The sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?